And it is 10 o'clock, or close enough, time for Off the Hook here on WBAI, New York. And a very good evening to everyone. This is Off the Hook. I'm Emmanuel Goldstein, and we're together every week at this time from 10 to 11, talking about the newest in high technology and the telephone system, the internet, and privacy concerns, and all kinds of hacker issues. Don't forget, hacker meeting this Friday at the CityCorp Center from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m., just follow all the security guards, and we're usually hanging out by the payphones, talking to people all over the world sometimes. And most of them call us, by the way. A couple of interesting news items that I'm sure people here would like to know about. Well, I don't know if you'd like to know about it so much, but you should know about it. All Californians may soon have to carry tamper-proof ID cards to prove they are U.S. citizens. I'm not kidding. That's if the state's political leaders have their way. Republican Governor Pete Wilson, who has built his re-election campaign on a call for a crackdown on illegal immigration, has raised the issue once again. He said a tamper-proof identification card will be necessary if Proposition 187 is approved by California voters on November 8th. That's next Tuesday. So if this concerns you and you want to contact all your friends and maybe make some new friends in California and let them know that Proposition 187 is, it's not cool, then maybe now is the time to do so, because next Tuesday people will vote on it, and if they pass this, who knows? Who knows what it's going to lead to, but California supposedly will be one of the first states to have this mandatory identification card that will prove that people are not those pesky aliens that need to be driven out at all costs, even cost to our privacy and freedom. Speaking of privacy and freedom, leads us to prisons. And do you know, this is something that I'm sure Fiber Optic will take an interest in, because he helped contribute to it. The nation's state and federal prison population has topped 1 million for the first time in history, hitting 1,012,851 at the end of June. Everyone in prison at that time gets a special certificate because they were part of this. Of the total, 919,143 were in state prisons and 93,708 were in federal prisons, according to Justice Department statistics. The total is more than double the 462,002 prison population of December 31st, 1984. They doubled it in 10 years, less than 10 years. At this rate, I don't want to think about it. Anyway, the state with the highest incarceration rate, guess. Anyone want to guess? No, it's not Pennsylvania. It's Texas, with 545 people sentenced for every 100,000 residents. New York was number six. We have 361 people behind bars for every 100,000 people. What are we heading towards? I don't know. I don't know where we're going. Okay. We're going to be talking about digital telephony tonight, and we'll be getting to that in just a moment. First, a couple of announcements. The Chaos Communications Congress, organized by the Chaos Computer Club and traditionally taking place between Christmas and New Year's, will this year again be offering a lot of interesting issues for the hitchhikers on the data highway and everybody else. After taking place in Hamburg for 10 years, this year the Congress opens itself in terms of both content and structure to a larger public. It will be held in the former Art Exhibition Hall right in the center of Berlin City on Breitscheidplatz, opposite the thing with the German name. Now that computers have turned out to be the most important new medium, questions of conception of this new medium, which will even overtake TV in importance, that's right, are gaining more and more social relevance. Terms such as interactive TV should contain much more than just a buy button on the remote control, which persuades you to buy any product you see in the commercials. To achieve this, visions are needed. Thanks to their self-created, freely accessible computer networks, which can offer a lot more speaking of interactivity, the hackers do not only reach the children's rooms in the information society, but also get into difficulties caused by large combines that are more and more regarding the networks as a field of activity. The industry is tending to lay a direct glass fiber connection right into our wallets, and the commercialization of information information ways involved threatens organizations that have a social interest, such as environmental or human rights organizations, parties, or trade unions whose aims are not in the first place financial ones. Well, it goes on for quite some time, actually. To keep the Congress as easy to understand as possible in terms of technical jargon, there will be introductory workshops on some issues, that is, the Internet. The Hack Center and the data filling stations in every room will be offering the possibility of critical and creative use of technology. It's happening December 27th through the 29th in Berlin, and they have prices for various combinations. If you're there for 3 days, it costs 42 Deutschmarks, which I think is about $42 now, if the dollar continues to do what it's been doing over the last few years. If you're a member of the Chaos Communications Club, that would be 23 Deutschmarks. And if you're a journalist, it jumps up to 75 Deutschmarks, and if you're a commercial in any way, it's 100. And if you're just there for 1 day, 20 Deutschmarks for regular people, 12 for pupils and unemployed persons. Anyway, if you want to call them up, you can reach them at 011, country code 49, city code 40, telephone number 490-3757. And I would give you an email address, except I don't see one here. If we get one, we'll certainly pass it along. Chaos, this is the 11th Chaos Communications Congress, again, taking place December 27th through 29th in Berlin. So that ought to be interesting. I've never been to one of those, so I don't really know what to expect as far as that kind of thing goes. Who knows? It might be Hope in German. Quite possible. All right. Before we get on to our discussion tonight as to digital telephony, what it means to all of us, we have a responsibility. Now, first of all, a couple of things, a couple of good bits of news. BAI listeners, as we have said many, many times, have power. That's right. We have lots and lots of power tied up in our big or little hands or what have you. We can get things changed, we can get things done in all kinds of marvelous ways. And that has happened yet again. That's right, a few weeks ago we revealed a scandal. The scandal was that a certain company was giving out information that perhaps they really shouldn't have given out. The information basically is that people's names, not names, actually, addresses were given out if you gave their phone numbers by calling up for this House of Windsor catalog. Well, that has changed. The number is still there. The number is still there, but when you call it, it does not give out the street address anymore. It gives out the street, but not the full street address. And that's something that has to be attributed to people calling and complaining. It's not 100% of the way there, but it's getting there. It's getting there. When they don't give out this information at all for anybody calling in with your phone number, then I think we will have succeeded in stopping this kind of invasion of privacy. Worked for even unlisted phone numbers. All you had to have was someone's phone number, and you were able to get their address. Well, now you're just able to get their street, but that's still a little bit too much. Also, from what I've heard, if you call the number more than three times from the same phone line, it will no longer work from that phone line. That's something that I have not yet verified, but I have heard that that is true. So that's something you might want to consider. Again, the number is 1-800-433-3210, and that is for the House of Windsor catalog. And by the way, every time you enter somebody's phone number, they will get a big red glossy catalog in the mail, so you might want to watch that. Okay, and as far as other rip-off services, ripping off either your privacy or your money, we've been talking over the past several weeks about 1-800-CALL-INFO, the MCI service, that charges 75 cents if you ask for a number. Now, it's okay to offer services, no one is objecting to that, but when you make an 800 number automatically bill back when somebody asks for a certain question, it's basically duplicating a 900 number, and it really shouldn't be an 800 number if it's doing the exact same thing as a 900 number. And what this does is make people hesitate when they see an 800 number. They don't know if they're going to be billed if they ask a certain question or if they perform a certain function. And it's basically devaluing the whole 800 service for every company, every person that has an 800 number. That's another reason why people should be very upset at this, apart from the consumer reason that you're getting charged for something that you really shouldn't be charged for. People install 900 blocks so that this kind of thing does not happen. Companies like MCI come in and bypass it by putting it on an 800 number. And on top of that, the worst of all, when they have these little advertisements on television, they don't even say what company they are. They don't say that it's MCI. Well, we say it's MCI. One thing, though, last week we called them, and we got them to tell us what time it was in Pensacola, Florida. And we noted that the time was an hour off from our time. At first we thought that was their mistake, but I have done some research into this, and it turns out, really fascinating actually, that Pensacola is as far west as Chicago, so therefore it's in the central time zone. So yes, MCI was correct in giving us the time, and they also saved us 36 cents from calling the time locally. So you can use this service for some things, but I don't suggest using it very often for information, as it costs the exact same amount as regular information, and the advertising practices they use are a bit, deceiving is a gentle way of saying it. Let's give them a call now, as we will do virtually every week, I think, and I think a lot of people should call them, too, just to see how they are. Oh, okay, we'll have to call it on a line that has paid the touch tone fee. Let's try this one.
...1-800-CALL-INFO, direct your assistance for only 75 cents. How would you like to bill your call?
Actually, I was curious about something. You also connect calls after you give out the phone number?
Yes, we do.
At what rate would I pay for that?
Well, sir, if you want specific rate information, I'll have to transfer you to customer service.
Customer service of what company?
MCI.
Oh, so this is actually MCI?
Yes, this is MCI product.
Okay, because I didn't see that in the advertisement anywhere.
Oh, okay.
All right. Well, you know what? I think I'll try back a little. What time do you have down there right now?
What time?
Yeah.
It is 12 after 9.
So you must be in the central time zone?
Yes, we are.
And you're in Pensacola, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, you know what? I'm going to call back probably later on tonight, close to midnight, and then I'll have a little bit more time to chat.
Okay, sir.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for being there.
Well, thank you for using 1-800-CALL-INFO.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Yeah, well, that was nice. We had a little fun with them, and they were very friendly to us. Okay, well, I just think we're adding such community to the whole phone system here. And it's an 800 number, so I don't ever have to worry about being billed for that now, do I? Okay, digital telephony, that's the serious subject for tonight. It's past. It's something that has happened. We've been talking about this for, I guess, a year now or so. It's basically a rather forbidding law that requires manufacturers of phone systems, central offices, PBXs, that kind of thing, to install mechanisms that make it easier for law enforcement to tap into the system. Now, as far as what specifically was what was passed and what was not passed, we're going to ask our expert guest tonight, Dave Banasar from EPIC, Electronic Privacy Information Center. Dave, are you there?
That I am. How you doing?
Pretty good. You're down there in Washington, D.C., or actually somewhere else, I think.
In the burbs of D.C.
Okay, in the burbs. What exactly was passed and what wasn't passed? Is this as bad as it was when they first introduced it? Or should we be happy? Should we be sad? What?
Well, to go into my Ross Perot imitation, you can take a big old ugly hog, and you can put a wig on it, you can put a dress on it, you can even put some makeup on it, but it's still a big old ugly hog.
I see your point.
So this is basically the same bill that they've been, they being the FBI, has been asking for a couple of years now, but it's it's got some window dressing on it now. They've tried to make it sound like they've compromised, but they basically get the same things that they've been asking for all along.
Now, what's some of the window dressing that might have changed that could have fooled people?
Well, they've put some what they want to call privacy protections on it, but if you actually look at them and read the text of the bill rather than certain press releases, they don't look that great after all. Frankly, they're rather trivial.
Uh-huh. Anything specific?
Well, they've put some restrictions on collecting records from online services, but if you read the actual text of the bill, it still allows the police to pretty much get access to anything they want with a subpoena. And then they have to go up to a really weak warrant provision to get the rest of the information. But they can still find out who you are. They can find out how long you've been on, what your information is, perhaps even who you've been talking to.
Now, could they not have found that out in the past?
Well, it depended on the service provider. The one I used down here had rules that said that they couldn't get anything from, the police couldn't get anything without a court order. And this lowers that to a subpoena, which is anything a government bureaucrat can ask for. When I was working for the public defender's office about 5 years ago, I could send out subpoenas.
Uh-huh. So it's that much easier now for them to do that.
Right.
Now, tell us something about the history of this law. Where was it introduced and what finally happened?
Well, this has been around for about 3 years now. It started out, the first bill was in 1991, and it really more dealt with the encryption side of things, but it had basically the same wording in some of its provisions. That one was rejected after a large number of people called up and screamed and yelled at their congressman.
Well, what wasn't the original reason why people were so upset because they said that the taxpayers would have to fund this?
Well, the bill in 91 didn't have anything one way or the other, but there was a general consensus that the way it was written, it would have required that all the phone companies and telecommunications companies decrypt all communications that went through their systems, which means they would have had to prohibit private encryption systems.
I see.
The 92 bill died because basically it would have been paid for by higher rates on telephone systems.
And that was the main reason why it died, because of that?
Well, there was a lot of reasons. I mean, there was obviously all the privacy reasons, and the phone companies were none too interested in rewiring all the systems at their own expense and then hoping that the public utility commissions would allow them to raise their rates.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of the reasons why it passed this time. One of the deals that was cut in the end on this bill was that the phone companies got $500 million worth of taxpayer money to be able to rewire their systems. There's a few other reasons, but that's one of the main ones.
Uh-huh. So now we're up to 92. What happened in 93?
In 93... when Clinton came in, apparently the first thing that the FBI people were saying was that they wanted to make this their number one legislative proposal. They waited until about November or so, and then they started talking about it seriously. And then when 94 came around, they actually introduced a bill. This time around, they got some people to help them out. They they convinced a couple senators that this was a good thing, and eventually our friends at the Electronic Frontier Foundation rolled over and decided to join them in supporting this bill.
That's something that's been a topic all over the net as to just why the EFF did that. Any suspicions?
Well, I think one of the reasons is sort of what we would call Washingtonitis. It's a propensity for somebody to come into town and want to become a big player here in the Washington scene. Ever since they fired their entire staff, and well, except for Mike Godwin, and moved down to D.C., they just have not been the same organization. These days, their entire funding, except for some money that KPOR gives them, comes from industry. So they're basically a trade association now.
And they're probably not in much danger of being called a hacker defense organization anymore.
I don't think there's any threat of that happening.
No.
Except maybe in a couple press releases that they send out.
Uh-huh.
They want to make it look like they're still the good guys.
So who opposed this?
Well, we worked very hard against it, and we worked closely with Voters Telecom Watch, which is a project that's based up by you and the Society for Electronic Access. The American Civil Liberties Union came in and wrote a very strong letter and lobbied Congress very hard. The U.S. Privacy Council, which is sort of an overall group of a number of different privacy groups and consumer groups, worked to try and kill this bill. And a lot of people, thousands of people, called, faxed, emailed their congressmen, their senators, asked them to kill this bill, and it came very close.
Well, now that Election Day is merely 1 week away, perhaps this would be a good time to mention some of the people that may have supported it or not supported it.
Well, one of the problems is when they passed the thing in the middle of the night a couple weeks ago, they passed it without taking an actual vote about who voted for it and who voted against it. So basically they got through the process without leaving any fingerprints, for the most part, on who did what.
They can pass bills without taking votes?
Well, they can if they do something called suspension of the rules in the House, which is basically how they pass just about everything that ever passes over there. If not more than one-third of the Congress opposes the bill, they don't take they take a voice vote, but not a written vote on who on the vote. And there's a similar measure that happened in the Senate.
Well, no. There must be some leaders, though, that have spoken out against it.
There was a number of people who, at one point or another, were opposing the bill. Senator Warner from Texas, or from Virginia, Senator Wallop from Wyoming, Senator Metzenbaum from Ohio, they all, at one point, were holding up the bill from being passed.
Uh-huh.
Congressman Brooks, for a while, looked like he was opposing the bill, but eventually he rolled over and shoved the thing through on the House side.
Do you know anything about New York representatives?
No, I don't.
Uh-huh. And it would be kind of hard to find out, wouldn't it?
As far as I know, neither of the senators played any kind of role in the bill, one way or the other.
Wow. So, now, what does this mean to the average person? I mean, someone who doesn't have anything to hide, why should they be concerned?
Well, I mean, that's always a question about privacy. You know, why should you worry about it if you don't have anything to hide? But, you know, I don't remember the last time somebody was pleased about seeing their medical records on the front page of the New York Times or there are consumer records used by some clown who decides to buy himself a house down in Florida using your good credit rating. There are a lot of reasons for privacy, a lot of basic human needs to have what you want known about yourself limited to the people that you want to know about. And this bill is basically one step, and a somewhat small step, but still a step towards designing all new technologies with surveillance built in. And the point of all this at some point is going to be a sort of enforced compliance of sort of like political correctness is now on a much bigger scale.
So now technically, any new phone system that is designed has to have something built in?
Right. The what is supposed to happen is any standard-setting body for telecommunications, that's things like ANSI, the American National Standards Institute, the TIA, any of those groups, are supposed to get together among themselves and develop standards based on what the FBI wants. And the FBI wants remote access to communications and phone number information instantaneously at remote government access centers. And these groups are supposed to design this, so just like they would be designing a new spec for how caller ID is supposed to work or how anything else, you know, call forwarding or a new service is supposed to work, they have to design everything with the specification of surveillance in the back of their heads. And if they can't get the surveillance built in, they're going to get into trouble.
Well, do you have any idea, though, how this is going to actually work? Will the feds be able to simply dial a special code into any phone system and be able to listen?
The way the language is written is that they're supposed to be able to have to have a phone company person there to turn it on. However, in some of the legislative hearings, the director of the FBI, Louis Free, was discussing about how on the smaller phone systems that they could easily design the software to make sure that nobody had to be there when they turned it on to save the phone company's money, of course.
Yeah, okay, make everybody happier in the process.
That's, I feel much better myself.
Dave Banisar from Electronic Privacy Information Center, I'm getting that right.
Right.
Okay. Tell us something about your group.
Well, we're a public interest group based down here in the belly of the beast in Washington, D.C. We used to be the Washington Office of Computer Professionals for Social Responsibility. Now we're a joint project of theirs and a civil liberties group called the Fund for Constitutional Government.
So there is still a CPSR.
Right. CPSR is a California-based organization with 20-some chapters. And we're still a project of theirs. We're just not the Washington office anymore.
I see. How can people get a hold of you?
Well, you can email us at info@epic.org, or we have a lot of information up at the CPSR FTP site at cpsr.org.
I'm sure there's a lot of people wringing their hair now or saying that they don't have net access. How do they get a hold of you?
Well, they can call at 202-544-9240.
Okay, good old-fashioned telephones that may or may not be listened to, depending on whether the feds have gotten around to you yet. It's pretty scary, and it seems to be in tune with a lot of other developments that are going on. I don't know if you heard the stories we were reading before about the California situation with the ID cards or the prison population. Do you think this is all related somehow?
Well, there certainly is a general measure towards more law and order at this moment, the war on drugs being the most popular thing at the moment.
Well, you don't want to be accused of being soft on crime now, do you?
Well, I'm not running for any office, so actually I don't have to worry about it, thankfully.
That's true, but maybe one day we'll all have to not be soft on crime.
I may regret this radio show.
Yeah, it could come back to haunt you in your political career.
The risk.
Yeah. Wow.
In terms of ID cards, there are certainly a lot of parallels. There is the government Tessera program, which is to design a clipper-like chip, which will go into ID cards for secure net access, and there's been some talk in the government about using that through the Postal Service for a lot of other services, and the Postal Service has said several times that they'd love to be able to issue an ID card, probably because they have no other reason to exist. Going. They certainly can't deliver the mail anymore.
Yeah, well, now, let's... it's depressing, what the things that we're hearing. Do you think there's anything that, I mean, is the Clipper chip, do you think that's the next thing that's going to go through now?
Well, the Clipper chip was a government standard, and they've already adopted it as a standard. The next question is whether they're going to try and make it mandatory. And shortly before the digital telephony bill passed, the director of the FBI was at a conference sponsored by everybody's friend Dorothy Denning. And at this conference, he was saying that if the Clipper chip did not become a standard that everybody used, criminals included, that he would go back down to Capitol Hill in a few years and ask for legislation to make it mandatory. There's already a bill that was introduced at the end of last session of Congress that would allow the FBI and the NSA to basically control the government crypto standard setting, which is very similar to what Free is asking for.
And, of course, that would also, in order to be effective, would have to be linked to something that would forbid your own independent form of encryption, right?
Right. I was at a technical conference today sponsored by ACM, and there was a lot of discussion about key escrow there. And there are still a lot of things that they aren't going to be able to solve if two rogue agents, people who just decide to go outside the escrow scheme, want to. They can always do that, and there is basically no real technical way of that being prevented.
Mm-hmm.
There, of course, could be some sort of law passed that makes it illegal, some sort of federal penalty for doing such a thing.
Right, but with law enforcement, it's very hard to enforce things like that.
Well, it would be used selectively against people that they had some other reason to nail and weren't able to do it and had this tool to use against them then.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Dave Vanasar from the Electronic Privacy Information Center down in Washington, D.C. If you have any questions concerning digital telephony or electronic freedom, privacy issues, things like that, or maybe if you just want to get more involved in the governmental process, give us a call, 212-279-3400, and we may also be joined by Fiber Optic later on if he's able to reach us. I know his funds were being depleted, so he may have run out of money for the phone. So we'll see if we hear from him in a little bit. 212-279-3400, let's take our first phone call. Good evening, you're on.
Oh, actually, what I wanted to talk about was the next Wednesday, right after the election, the Public Service Commission in New York is going to begin hearings on the plan that would determine how we're going to be charged for telephone service for the next 7 years. It's the New York 9X's incentive regulation plan, which just came out of settlement hearings, which were on a confidential basis. They finally released the plan with about 17 signatures. People like MCI and AT&T and cable television didn't sign it, but it's going up for, unless they get another delay, it's going up for litigation starting next Wednesday up in Albany. And so far, the plan calls for certain rate reductions for customers in the New York area. Nassau, some customers will get a reduction on their flat rate, a charge from 22.27 down to 2016. People in Great Neck, for instance, would go from 18.02 to 16.65.
And perhaps the most important part of this whole plan is the elimination of the touchtone fee once and for all.
Yes, that would apply to about 78% of the people.
And we're going to have one heck of a party when that happens.
But, of course, there are many ramifications of this. It may be that if the regulation isn't stringent and very specific, they could be earning crazily because they are talking about reducing the workforce from 9 to 13,000, which would mean their productivity costs and everything would be it would give them a tremendous bottom line where they make tremendous profits. So, it is going to be a very important
Okay, so, just to sum up, when does this begin and how long does it last?
Oh, well, the hearings begin on Wednesday, November 9th, up in Albany. They may have some in New York, and I'll call you and let you know if that takes place. But I'd just like to mention for people in Nassau County, for instance, and Suffolk County, and in Westchester County, there are important reductions in a lot of the flat rate charges for residential customers. Now, there's a problem about what about New York City? Is New York City going to get any reductions on their basic rate? Because New York City, except for little spots in Queens and possibly, Staten Island, don't have an opportunity for flat rate service. So, but the there is money because the commission had found in a previous case, and they haven't paid out all this money yet, that the phone company had earned too much money, and according to the old way of regulation by rate of return, that they were supposed to give back a lot of this money. Now, the only application that was made was, number one, the elimination of the 50-cent touch-tone charge for residential customers. Business customers will come in on this in a couple of years, mm-hmm. but the residential will get it, assuming that the plan goes into effect in January of 95.
Mm-hmm.
That'll take effect now. I want to point out that Buffalo, Erie County, and Nassau County had a representative in these proceedings, which resulted in having some give back of basic charges to some customers.
Mm-hmm.
But the city of New York was there, but they had a representative there, but the representative apparently didn't have anything to offer about what could be done for New York City's customers who only have message rate. It might be that they should institute a flat rate option for various communities.
Well, that would certainly be a very popular thing to have here in New York. So I want to thank you for the info, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more about this in the weeks ahead. Thanks again. I believe we have Fiber Optic with us. Fiber, are you there?
Yes, we do.
All right. Fiber, Dave Benassar is also on the line.
How you doing?
Hi.
And this is probably the first time you guys have talked since Fiber went away.
It's been a while. Yeah.
We're discussing the digital telephony law and how it's going to affect people. Fiber, maybe you have some observations on that or questions.
Well, yeah. I was curious. I mean, I remember what the whole thing encompassed, and I thought that the industry wasn't going to cooperate, and they didn't have any corporations backing them. So, what exactly is it going to entail is my question. Are they actually mandating that telecommunications companies are now going to have to build in these eavesdropping mechanisms?
Well, they're requiring all the standard-setting bodies to do the standards for it, and if the bodies don't do it, then the FCC is going to step in and set the requirements. So, yes, they are.
Wow.
In exchange, the telecom companies get $500 million to play with.
Wow.
And we have to raise that money somehow. And we got to do it quick, too, because it's coming out of our pockets.
Save your penny jars.
So, Mark, are you surprised by that?
I'm really surprised. It seems like so much changes since I went away.
Yeah.
But I see two problems. The first problem is that people shouldn't lose sight of the fact that there's plenty of phone company-type testing mechanisms that are already inherent in most of the infrastructure of the telephone company as it is now. And if hackers can figure out how to use these type of mechanisms to eavesdrop on conversations the way things are now, then I see things only getting worse if they're going to have to engineer mechanisms that are going to allow people like the FBI, many of whom aren't technically inclined, to be able to eavesdrop remotely. And by facilitating a mechanism like that, it seems like it's going to be a whole lot easier for the wrong types of people to abuse that mechanism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely going to be some rough riding ahead as far as privacy and telecommunications go. Dave, is there any kind of counter-strike to this in the works, or is the battle over, or are there other things we can do?
Well, next session they're going to have to appropriate the money to spend the $500 million, and there's certainly an opportunity at that point that we're going to try and lead the charge to get the money struck out of the bill, which means they could demand all they want, but they wouldn't have any money to spend, and the phone companies won't do a thing without the money.
Uh-huh. Do you think there's a reasonable chance we can do that?
I think it's worth the effort.
Uh-huh.
If nothing else, we'll drive them up the wall.
Yeah.
One all through ulcers or something.
Uh-huh. Okay, let's take a couple more phone calls. Good evening, you're on.
Hello. I was listening to this, and concerning these ID cards, don't be surprised if you hear something like if the media may raise the word eminent domain. When you hear that, you know you've got real big problems. Bill?
Do you want to go into a little more detail on that?
How can I explain this? The situation is that people will have, I didn't expect to get on this soon. But nonetheless, I'm surprised. I don't even know where to start. I had another thing I was going to speak about, a little more on the light side and some more on the technical.
Well, let's stick to this for now.
Okay. Eminent domain is the situation where you'd have a number of civil liberties groups. They're already on the case here. And that's all I know. There's going to be a point where eminent domain's like, we must keep order, and so we're going to have to, we're going to have to deal with this in this manner.
Uh-huh. So basically a crisis situation.
Exactly. When we know we have an administration that seems to be very professional at creating crises, thanks to the media, or the established media, if you will.
Right. And the crisis in the California case would be the illegal aliens.
Exactly. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks for the call.
All right. Okay, bye.
Take care. Fiber, I mailed you some of those articles, too. Did you get them?
Yeah, yes, I did today.
And, I should congratulate you for helping us make the million mark in prison.
I feel lucky to have been able to contribute to something like that.
And you do get a plaque for this, don't you?
Oh, I hope so. Maybe I'll find out when I leave.
I mean, they couldn't have done it without people like you all over the world, the country anyway.
So because you're leaving so soon, they may kind of try and cheat you out of that plaque.
Yeah, but for every one person that leaves, another two come in.
It's getting me more than that.
Well, your prison is incredibly overcrowded, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. In fact, the actual statistics are that this place was built for roughly 180 people. And right now, as I speak, there are well over 300 people.
That's just in your little section, though.
I'm talking about in the whole camp. The whole camp was built for 180 people. Two buildings.
But you're not talking about the place across the street. You know, the
Oh, that's the FCI. That,
yeah.
That houses, I think, about 1,000 people.
Right, okay.
Talking just the camp, just alone, where we live here.
Uh-huh.
It was supposed to be for 180 people, and there's over 300 living here.
Amazing. Yeah, they have people living in hallways and TV rooms?
Well, just the TV rooms.
TV rooms, okay.
If you could get close enough to the building and look into the window of the upstairs TV room, you'd see the window filled with bits.
Well, we could try that, but we'd be shot while we were out there. So I don't know if it's worth the effort.
Become a permanent resident there.
Yeah, that's true, too. They might ask you to stay.
Yeah.
All right, let's take another phone call. Good evening. You're on.
Hi. I have a question about the 950 exchange.
Can you speak up a bit?
Yeah, I have a question about the 950 exchange.
Yes.
Is that free or?
950 is free. Maybe Fiber can explain it better than I can.
Well, it certainly is free. What else did you want to know about it?
I mean, do you have any other questions about it?
Yeah, I have a question about, like, Amnex and TVXs.
Okay.
I want to know, like, about ANI and like, what it is, really.
What is ANI?
Okay, that's a good question.
Sure, it's a good question. Well, in brief, at least, it's a means of a switching system, basically a computer that processes your phone calls, the means for it to signal to some other computer somewhere, whether it be another switching system or something. Basically, your telephone number is the main purpose of it. Let's say, for example, you're calling an 800 number. Your switching system obviously knows what your phone number is since you're directly connected to it. And it is your switching system. It processes your calls. So what it's going to do when it does a connection to an 800 number, leaving out all the technical stuff that happens in between, which isn't really important, the important thing is that your local switching system, the computer itself, is going to signal your telephone number to the switch at the other end, and that's how it knows where you're calling from. This has nothing to do with caller ID. You should bear that in mind.
Yeah, well, caller ID, while it may get the same information in the end, it gets it in a totally different way.
Yeah.
And different equipment is required and all that kind of thing. Okay, but I guess maybe what he was getting at was is ANI passed on when you use a 950 number?
It wasn't in the past. I mean, that may have changed. Traditionally, 950s were known as a feature group B number, and the feature groups go... It was reserved for 950s, and all they were the predecessor, basically, to equal access. I mean, the only reason they're holding on to the 950 exchange is that I know numerous companies are using it for purposes that have absolutely nothing to do with long distance.
Such as Domino's.
Right. Initially, it was strictly for long distance carriers, and there were no numbers over 1,999.
Uh-huh.
They only assigned from 0000 to 1999.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, now that's changed, and also the purpose for the exchange has changed. So it's certainly possible that today they could be passing ANI simply because they're offering newer services that had nothing to do with its original purpose.
950 numbers are still a way to make a cheap phone call without having all those surcharges if you can find a company that actually offers you the service. For instance, Cable and Wireless, Metromedia, you can basically use a code, call a number someplace, and pay almost the same amount that you would pay if you dialed direct from your home. As opposed to AT&T, MCI, Sprint, who will all give you large surcharges for making a call in the first place. So 950s apparently allow you to do that. Fiber, how are you doing on time?
I have about 3 minutes left. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to call back.
Oh, why is that?
Where the show ends. Well, I've been waiting here for quite some time, and a little bit of stupidity happened tonight that caused them to close down the entire administration building.
What is a little bit of stupidity, or don't you want to get into it?
It involved, apparently, at least from what I heard, somebody had attempted to use one of the TAN in-house telephones in one of the off-limits rooms down in the administration building, and apparently set off a red light somewhere on some main phone, either in the office in the admin building or down at the FCI.
Uh-huh.
And apparently they radioed up and... told the people up here that somebody had tried to use one of the in-house telephones, and they decided that they were going to lock down the entire building and not let anybody get into it.
Wow, so that happened until just recently, I guess.
Oh, that happened tonight.
But they let everybody back in? Or are you calling from someplace else?
I'm calling from my housing unit.
Oh, I see.
So we're basically roughly 160 people using two telephones.
Oh, that's bad. Well, so there's a whole line of people there waiting to use it. I bet you're the only one that has a radio show to be on.
Yeah, I guess so.
Although I don't want to jump to conclusions. Well,
maybe the next guy can call.
Have the next guy call us, and we can put him on instead. Well, Fiber, we're not on next week because we have to do the post-mortem for the election day and fret about what's ahead.
Yeah.
But we will be on again in 2 weeks. Now, you're going to be out on the 22nd.
That's right. Yeah, Tuesday the 22nd.
Okay, that means you'll be here live in the studio on the 23rd. And,
that's right.
We're looking forward to that like nothing.
Yeah.
Even more than Thanksgiving the day after.
Well, that was just my magic click, if anybody else heard it.
Okay, so you have, what, about a minute now?
A few seconds now.
A few seconds. Okay, well, say whatever you want to say.
Well, I look forward to coming back, obviously, and I look forward to having a lot of fun that Wednesday, the 23rd.
Okay. Sounds good to me. Dave, you have anything to say in the last couple of seconds with Fiber?
Congratulations. I'll be seeing you out here in the so-called free world.
Yep, see you on the other side.
Okay. We'll let you click off naturally, Fiber.
A graceful exit.
Yeah, a graceful exit, and we're going to take some more phone calls here. 212-279-3400. Oh, there he goes. We're here with Dave Banasar. You're still with us in the free world, right?
Well, here in Maryland, at least.
Okay, close enough. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. Two privacy items. First, to try to give a simpler answer to the caller who asked about ANI, that is basically for 800 and also 900 service operators. One reason I have 800 service at home is so that I can extract the phone numbers of people who might not want to give me their number. It won't show on my call ID, but if they're calling from the U.S. or Canada, their area code and phone number will appear on my 800 bill at the end of the cycle when the bill comes.
Well, do you know if you use either Wiltel or cable and wireless, it will show up in your caller ID box.
Or cable and wireless, thank you. So I must get... Now, Wiltel do a nice credit investigation of you before they let you sign up, by the way.
Oh, that's nice.
I don't know about cable and wireless. And Wiltel have an unpleasant connection with sort of rip-off company Encore, but so it's Wiltel and cable and wireless, right, which could let some of us drop our 800 service for that reason. Of course, the 500 and the 700 service let you do it either way. You can give people a call reversing PIN, and then same as with 800 service, their calling numbers appear on your bill.
Mm-hmm.
They pay for the call, then their calling area code and number do not appear on your bill. And what I do is when I want to extract it, I will sometimes have the where they try to pay for it themselves, it will go into a line that I use only for outgoing calls and don't answer or have any rings on incoming, forcing them to use the code and make me pay for the call incoming, but it lets me extract the number when I get my next bill for the AT&T True Connections service, and I trust the other companies when they introduce the 500 service, it'll work the same way.
That's quite an operation you've got going over there.
No.
Sounds like you're running a small government.
Who likes to be able... I'm the guy who thanked you so much for the thing about the Windsor catalog, you
right.
remember?
Did you get yours?
Oh, well, I never put my own number.
Oh, okay.
But what? I did check all my numbers, and happily, by having completely unlisted service, they said, I'm sorry, we cannot help you on all my regular and ringmate numbers, so I was very relieved at that.
Well, that's not necessarily the reason, because we did have unlisted numbers show up with addresses, numbers that had always been unlisted.
Right, and I appreciated that. I noticed that. And anyway, what was the other thing? Before I go to my second point that I was going to say about this 800. Oh, I was talking with Bell Canada, who are the local company for the Quebec and Ontario provinces, and they were saying how they always get the number on their call ID. They call it call display. When people call from the States hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles away, though never the name if it involves enhanced call ID, the caller's name, if it's a listed party, seems to never cross the border.
Well, not yet, anyway.
I'm right.
Okay, now, quickly, what is your second point, because we have other calls?
Their trial period for the block the blocker, in other words, star 77 or 1177 or anonymous call rejection,
right,
supposed to have ended October 31st, but they've extended it for whatever silly reason to December 31st, so hopefully about New Year's we'll start being able to actually use star 77 in the rest 9X customers in the rest of New York State.
Block those people that dare to be anonymous. Okay. Thanks for the info.
Sure.
You can do that now also with hardware. There is hardware that will detect a call that comes in that's a private number, and will play a message for them. But that does result in a call completion.
Jump onto my soapbox here, if
go ahead.
I can, for a second. This really does seem, except for that small group of people that seem to want it, like the preceding caller, it just seems like another phone company scheme to try and make it as hard as possible to keep your anonymity and to enhance the caller ID service. I think this has very little to do with privacy.
Absolutely, I agree. I look at it as more of a toy, and I think that's what most of our listeners look at it as, something to play with, something to figure out how to defeat or what does in certain circumstances. So in that regard, they may seem a little eager to see these things. But, yeah, the privacy implications are obviously far more important, and they should be looked upon very, very closely. The whole caller ID argument, I still do not agree with at all as far as this is going to cut down on harassing phone calls. I think all this does is make for this air of confrontation before you even pick up the telephone. I can't tell you now how many times you accidentally dial a number and right away your phone rings back with someone demanding to know why you called them. You know, it really makes for unpleasantness. Anyway, 212-279-3400. Let's fit a few more in. Good evening.
Yes, good evening. I'd like to know about that number in Washington, D.C. on information on the Clipper chip bill that was passed. Hello?
Yeah, Dave, I think that's you.
You want our number, the bill number, or Congress's number?
Your number.
It's 202-544-9240. And if you have any sort of online service, you can get copies of the bill off our CompuServe, America Online, or the net.
Okay, thank you. By the way, I'd like to know if, Mr. Goldstein, if you're familiar with an article in the New York Times Magazine on June 12th dealing with the battle over the Clipper chip technology. It was an article by Stephen Levy discussing a man by the name of Whitfield Duffy, who was a cryptographer.
Uh-huh.
Who had some breakthroughs in the science of cryptology, which could ensure some kind of privacy on the line or some kind of defense against something like Clipper chip technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did see the article. Cryptography is not my field of expertise, but it certainly is something that a lot of people are paying strict attention to these days. And the group of people that I feel more comfortable with are known as cypherpunks, and I think we have to look towards people like that.
Yes, they also covered cypherpunks in the article also.
Right, I think they were on the front cover, actually.
No, Mr. Duffy was on the front cover.
Oh, okay, I'm thinking of something else then.
Yeah, Gilmore and Hughes, they mentioned Gilmore and Hughes as two cypherpunks who were part of that group.
Uh-huh. Okay, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Dave, you let something slip there. You guys actually use AOL and CompuServe?
Yeah, God forbid.
How come?
We do, but we can't all be net denizens, and it's important to get our message out as wide as possible.
Uh-huh. But is the reason because you can't get access any other way?
Well, no, I have full net access. But through a regular service provider, but I know a lot of people don't.
Uh-huh. Oh, I see. So it's for their benefit.
Right.
Because they can't get out from there. Okay.
God forbid I don't use CompuServe for the enjoyment.
Well, I was concerned. I just felt if you had a problem, you needed a helping hand. So, okay. But people do need to know that the net is not what CompuServe, AOL, and all those other services have in mind. It's something much more magical and mystical.
Yeah, I believe that's what it is.
Yeah, well, it's supposed to be anyway. Good evening, you're on. Speak up.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, recently I got a call from 9X, and they told me that someone got hold of my credit card, calling card number, and did about $600 worth of calls.
Okay.
And how can I protect myself against this thing in the future?
Well, the 9X calling card is physically it's pretty secure because it only has four digits on it. It doesn't have your phone number on it. However, did you order a 9X calling card?
Yes, I did, and I used it a couple times at the airport.
Okay, someone could have looked over your shoulder. Someone could have been tapping into the line and recording the touch tones. There's all kinds of different ways. The important thing, though, for you to know is that you're not liable for those calls.
All right, good.
Even if 9X had not notified you, if you see something show up on your bill that does not belong to you, even if somebody looks over your shoulder, that doesn't make you guilty of a crime.
I see.
These are digits, and it's an inherently insecure system to start with.
Right.
We had a situation not too long ago where 9X mailed us a calling card we didn't ask for, and they mailed it to the wrong address. The person at that address opened it, said, "Hey, this isn't mine," wrote on the envelope, "Send back," and 9X put that envelope into another envelope and sent it to our proper address, basically telling us, "We don't care that other people have looked at your calling card. Here it is," you know?
I see.
Yeah, so it's not something that I would worry about too much, but definitely keep an eye on your phone bill.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. Hey, we're out of time. Dave, thanks very much for stopping in yet again. Some of you might have seen Dave Manasar at the Hope Conference talking about privacy and actually predicting quite accurately that this digital telephony thing could very well pass in the next couple of months. Well, it did. I guess something like this kind of strengthens you in a way, makes you want to fight more, but at the same time, it definitely has to be looked at as a defeat. And I have to agree with you, Dave, as far as not siding with the Electronic Frontier Foundation in this, saying that it's some kind of a victory. I still don't quite understand what that stance comes from.
Well, you know, they get a lot of their money these days from AT&T and Microsoft, so I guess if you're AT&T or Bell Atlantic and you got $500 million to play with, you could call it a victory.
Yeah, I guess that might be one way of looking at it. We're going to hear more on this whole issue in the weeks and months ahead. Dave, again, thanks for stopping by, and we'll be in touch in the future.
Talk to you soon.
Okay. And that is our show for tonight. We're not going to be on next week because of post-election day. However, we will be back in 2 weeks, so we'll see you then. Stay tuned for a rebroadcast of the WBAI Evening News here on WBAI New York. Good night.
Good evening. In the news tonight, the NAACP lays off much of its national staff, but officials say that while they're down, they are not out. Anti-abortion activist Paul Hill is convicted of murder and could face the death penalty. And we look at the legacy of progressive publisher Irwin Knoll. With these and other stories, I'm Jose Santiago in New York with Verna Avery Brown in Washington, and this is the news for Wednesday, November 2, 1994. First to Washington for the Pacifica National News.
Today, President Clinton campaigned for Democrats in Rhode Island.
Every voter in this country on Tuesday is just like somebody that has a remote control on a movie about America. They can push forward, fast forward, or reverse. Do not push reverse. You will regret it, and so will America.
In polls released today, Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy is 15 points ahead of Republican challenger Mitt Romney. Texas Governor Ann Richards holds a statistically insignificant edge over Republican George Bush. However, the poll was taken before yesterday's endorsement of Richards by Texas billionaire Ross Perot. In Florida, Governor Lawton Childs has moved slightly ahead of Republican Jeb Bush. In Chicago, a federal judge has ordered a white family sued for racial harassment by their Puerto Rican neighbors to move out. The Ramos family charged that the Crafts had threatened and harassed them ever since the Puerto Rican couple moved into the Chicago's northwest side in 1985. The Ramos family was suing the Crafts for $10 million. The judge had held the Crafts in contempt of court for violating an order to stay at least 50 feet away from the Ramos family and not to speak to them. Now, under an agreement reached between both sides, the Crafts must put their house on the market immediately and be out of the house within 120 days. The man charged with Saturday's shooting at the White House will be held without bond until his trial, so ruled a federal judge today. The defense attorney had argued that Francisco Martin Duran was firing at a building and no one was hurt, so the 26-year-old Colorado resident was not a danger to the public. The judge rejected that argument and found there was probable cause to proceed to trial on 4 felony charges. Today's Washington Post reports that prosecutors are considering charging Duran with attempted assassination of the president. The paper says a co-worker of Duran's has told the FBI that Duran said he was going to Washington to take out the president, and a map was found in Duran's truck with the words "Kill the Prez" written on it. Workers at San Francisco's two daily newspapers are on strike today. The 2,600 union members have been working without a contract for over a year. Pickets prevented delivery trucks from leaving newspaper printing plants this morning. Larry Binsky has this report from the San Francisco Bay Area.
Thousands of subscribers to the Morning Chronicle and Afternoon Examiner have reportedly pledged to cancel their subscriptions in case of a strike. And when negotiations broke off late last night, the union employees began distributing a pre-printed 8-page strike paper, the San Francisco Free Press. Morning Chronicle and Afternoon Examiner officials have said they plan to continue publishing using replacement workers. However, this morning, delivery trucks were vandalized outside a printing plant, and only a few thousand of the Chronicle's usual 500,000 daily newspapers were available. The newspapers have a joint business operation, but both have been losing circulation steadily over the past few years. The Chronicle is down almost 10% in circulation this year alone. Striking workers are demanding wage increases and an end to planned layoffs of delivery drivers and hundreds of young people who deliver the papers. Observers have long predicted that a strike like this one would probably mean the end of one of the newspapers, and should that happen, San Francisco will join a growing list of major cities in the United States as a one-newspaper town. For Pacifica Network News, I'm Larry Bensky.
Israel plans to seal the homes of three Palestinians who took part in last month's abduction of Israeli Corporal Nachshon Waksman. The families have 48 hours to appeal. Although Israel has issued 8,000 new entry permits to Palestinians, only a few hundred workers came across the border into Israel today. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin has said that the border closure will be gradually lifted. And those are the stories topping the news. Have employers found a loophole in the nation's anti-discrimination laws? That's the question which confronted the U.S. Supreme Court today in the age discrimination case of Christine McKinnon. But civil rights advocates argue a ruling from the high court could reach well beyond the aging issue and the graying baby boom generation. Pacifica's Don Rush reports.
The case involves Christine McKinnon. For 39 years, she had worked for the National Banner Publishing Company as a secretary. But in 1990, at the age of 62, she was fired with one day's notice. The publisher claimed the dismissal was part of downsizing the company. In turn, McKinnon filed a lawsuit charging age discrimination. She noted that company officials had been pressuring her to retire. But during discovery, she admitted secretly taking and copying confidential documents to bolster her case. The company immediately said this constituted misconduct subject to dismissal. And today, attorney Eddie Whalen argued before the U.S. Supreme Court this invalidated her age discrimination claim.
Congress did not intend to reward and protect bad apples, bad employees. That's why the statute specifically says that good cause for termination will not be a violation of the statute. And this Congress recognized that not every plaintiff is going to have a remedy in a discrimination case.
But a number of justices appear to be skeptical. For instance, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg noted that the statute says, "Thou shalt not discriminate." And conservative Justice Antonin Scalia observed that Whalen's interpretation would open the door to close scrutiny of a plaintiff's employment history. Michael Terry, McKinnon's attorney.
It'll devastate an employee's opportunity to bring a civil rights case. As I believe Justice Scalia mentioned, anybody who brings a lawsuit with this type of defense out there is going to have their entire employment and pre-employment history gone over.
But the company played down the impact of a decision in their favor, saying it would affect only a small percentage of cases. Again, company attorney Eddie Whalen.
This is not something that's going to knock out all discrimination plaintiffs. It's not a bar to all complaints. As I said earlier, it's probably some 10,000ths of a percentage of the discrimination cases that have been filed over the last 4 years that this even applies to.
That's absolutely incorrect.
Richard Seymour with the Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights Under Law.
The United States Chamber of Commerce, which filed a brief on behalf of the employer, estimated that more than 40% of all employees in the United States had some kind of significant omission or misstatement on their application forms. defense lawyers generally, when they hold their conferences and talk to each other and write articles for each other to read, have treated this as the best Christmas present they ever got.
McKinnon's case is also expected to affect race and sex discrimination cases. Helen Norton with the Women's Legal Defense Fund, which filed a brief in the case.
If they can basically argue, and they do, yes, we may have harassed her, we did commit sexual harassment, but the bottom line is she puffed her resume, or she took home, as Christine McKinnon did, she took home some confidential documents because she was worried about losing her job. They can completely insulate themselves from liability.
The lower courts are divided on the issue, and in the case of Christine McKinnon, she is seeking reinstatement of her lawsuit. Her attorney, Michael Terry, says his client is asking for back pay and financial compensation.
My client, who is not here, who is in Nashville, tending to her 99-year-old mother, would say that she would be very happy that other people didn't have to face this defense. That would probably be enough for Christine McKinnon.
Don Rush, Pacifica Network News, Washington.
NAACP has stopped paying most of its professional staff. The furlough took effect Monday, and officials hope it won't last more than a week or two. But the move shows how desperate the situation has become at the national office, which faces a $3.5 million deficit. Pacifica's Mark Beavis has more.
The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People has a national paid staff of about 100 people and a yearly budget of $15 million. But the organization's growing deficit of $3.5 million is taking its toll. The executive committee made the decision last Saturday to lay off 80 people without pay for 2 weeks, effective last Monday. The savings to the organization should come to about $220,000 in salaries. Officials at the NAACP in Baltimore were unavailable for comment, but Interim Administrator Earl Schinhoster is reported as saying the NAACP can't spend what it doesn't have. The only staff members who continue to get paid are those working on special projects funded by specific grants. Dr. Julian Bond, a lifetime member of the organization and a candidate for the upcoming Board of Directors election, says the NAACP has never seen such a dark day.
There have been times in the past when staff have gone without a paycheck. There have been times in the past when the organization was in some modest financial difficulty in arrears with its bills. But there has never been a time in NAACP history where almost every single employee had to take a series of payless work days. Never in a time when the deficit was so large. And never a time when public confidence in the NAACP needed so badly to be restored.
And Bond places much of the blame for the NAACP's condition squarely on the shoulders of former executive director Benjamin Chavis and chairman of the board William Gibson. C. Dolores Tucker agrees. Tucker is a member of the NAACP's National Board of Trustees and a chair of the National Political Congress of Black Women, and she thinks Chairman Gibson's days are numbered.
I think if anybody else ran a corporation into the situation that it is in now, it's just about almost bankrupt, I think they wouldn't stay there very long. And I think that whatever Mr. Chavis did, he did it with his authority. In fact, when it was revealed that the contract was made and money was spent, he stood by the side of Mr. Chavis and said he supported him fully. Mr. Chavis could not do any, he wouldn't have been hired without Dr. Gibson's blessings, and he would not have done what he did without his blessings, and so he is culpable.
The NAACP board fired Benjamin Chavis August 20th, based partially on charges that he mismanaged the organization's funds when he tried to secretly settle a sexual discrimination lawsuit for $332,000. William Gibson, the NAACP chair since 1985, also faces allegations that he has misused his expense account accepting reimbursement for expenses already charged to the organization. Gibson has denied the accusations. But 2 weeks ago, the board voted to order an outside audit of all officers' expenses going back to 1989. In the meantime, a plan is afoot to raise money for the national organization from the 220 local branch offices. The idea is to have each branch send $1,000 to the national office and thereby raise over $2 million. Lillian McGriff, president of the San Francisco office, believes the plan will work. She says her branch is sending money.
Many branches have that much money. I mean, most branches have that much money that they can certainly send to the national office without a fundraiser. You know, so, I mean, some of the smaller branches may have some difficulty, and they may have to put on a fundraiser to raise money. But the larger branches certainly have that kind of money they can send to the national office.
Despite the financial problems at the national level, and despite the fact the organization's image has suffered, the work of the NAACP goes on, because as Julian Bond points out, it's the strength of the local branches that keeps the nation's oldest and largest civil rights organization from falling apart.
Even as we're speaking, all around the country, individual NAACP branches, almost all of them staffed by volunteers who are not dependent on a paycheck from the national organization, are registering voters. They're gearing up to turn out large numbers of black voters on Election Day next Tuesday. They are investigating discrimination complaints. They're running SAT clinics for black high school kids. They're running anti-drug campaigns. They're doing all of the work of the NAACP. The crisis at the headquarters in Baltimore is serious, but it's not going to prove fatal to the NAACP. This organization is too important for black or white Americans to let slip away.
The NAACP board elections are scheduled for December. There is some speculation among observers that NAACP Chair William Gibson will step down by February. Mark Beavis, Pacifica Network News, Washington.
There's a new gold rush in Oregon. The Newmont Mining Corporation plans to open Oregon's first gold pit mine in public land at Grassy Mountain. While Newmont promises jobs, some residents are nonetheless not happy about the mine. Congress's failure to reform mining laws has left western states with the job of making sure that mining companies operating on public lands clean up after themselves. Oregon passed what has been called the toughest mining law in the nation in 1991, but some say even that law doesn't go far enough. That's why grassroots environmental activists are pushing for passage of Measure 14, a ballot initiative that would require additional environmental protection. From Portland, Alexi Rubenstein reports.
From downtown Ontario, it's an hour-long drive through sagebrush country along bumpy roads to Grassy Mountain. Gary Brown and his wife Carolyn were born and raised in this eastern Oregon town and have dedicated the last 8 years fighting a proposed gold mine that will level Grassy Mountain.
Back in 1988, we were all maybe 4 miles west of this area. And I walked over the horizon. Here were some claim stakes just at stake. One of the pieces of the paper that was on one of the claim posts said that there was gold. And gee whiz, you know, I've heard stories all my life that there was gold out here, but gee whiz, nobody ever found any. And, you know, that's kind of crazy.
Congress enacted the 1872 mining law when Ulysses S. Grant was president in order to encourage prospecting and settlement of the West. Under the law, mineral rights on public lands are still sold for the 1872 price, as little as $5 an acre. Critics of the law say that it fails to address the environmental impacts of today's large-scale mining technologies. Newmont and other mining companies, using a process called cyanide heap leach mining, remove millions of tons of earth and, using cyanide, extract microscopic flakes of gold. At Grassy Mountain, the foreign-owned Newmont Corporation plans to remove over 1 million tons of earth and dig a 2,000-foot-wide, 800-foot-deep open pit, all to produce the amount of gold it takes to fill the back of a standard pickup truck. Gary Brown says what Newmont will leave behind is an empty pit and piles of tailings debris.
Tailings is all the gunk that's left in the mining process that nobody wants. So you've got a lot of heavy metals, the mercuries, the cadmiums, the leads, that's not economical to pull out. They only want the gold that has the high value. What you're left there with is a pile of very hazardous material. That's going to be there forever.
Brown says the primary reason for Measure 14 is to require mining companies to refill the open pits they dig in order to prevent acid mine drainage, which happens when mine tailings are exposed to water and oxygen. Brown says he wants the pit refilled so that it doesn't fill with acidic water. Grassy Mountain's previous leaseholder, Atlas Precious Metals, said that water would fill up in the pit. But in Denver, Newmont Senior Vice President Chip Clark denies the potential for acidic water buildup.
There isn't going to be any water. The water table in that area is well below the bottom of the pit. So there isn't going to be a problem with water coming in contact with sulfide surfaces of the rock.
According to the Mineral Policy Center, Newmont is one of the more environmentally responsible mining companies. But even at Newmont's Showcase Mine, the Rain Mine in Elko, Nevada, Clark agrees that there have been environmental problems. In June 1990, acid mine drainage flowed from waste rock piles, releasing heavy metals into a nearby stream, turning the water red for 2 miles. And in March 1993, acid mine drainage was discovered again. Despite the accidents, Newmont's Chip Clark says it is extremely costly to refill an open pit. He says it is usually better environmentally to cover tailings outside of a pit rather than let them sit exposed for a decade or more until the mine is finished and then backfill. If Measure 14 passes and Newmont is required to fill the pit, Clark says the company would reduce the scale of mining operations and hire fewer local workers, and the local economy would receive less benefits. It's a message Newmont has spent over $1.6 million trying to communicate to Oregon voters.
We've got a choice, whether to keep our new mining law, which is a good, tough law, or whether to destroy it by passing Measure 14, which is deceptive, would cost jobs, and cost state taxpayers millions.
Despite the talk about the high-wage jobs that are generated, I've yet to find anybody that can point to a prosperous mining region in the United States.
Thomas Power is chairman of the Department of Economics at the University of Montana in Missoula.
Mining areas are known for two things, poverty and ghost towns. So that, I mean, we know what mining leads to. There's no mystery. The question is whether there's enough positive payoff in the short term so that people are willing to put up with what they know are going to be long-term negative consequences.
Sitting on a rock outcropping at the summit of Grassy Mountain, Gary Brown says he and his wife realize that the public lands of Grassy Mountain will be mined. They just want to ensure that it is done responsibly. For this, mining advocates have called Brown a radical environmentalist, a label he finds amusing.
I am trying to look toward the future to my daughter's children, to grandchildren, to future generations, and saying, okay, now if I was to come along 100 years from now, what would I say about this situation? And I know what I would say is, why didn't my grandparents take care of it in their day? Why were they more concerned about making the dollar today and not concerned about me here in the future?
Chip Clark says that depending on the results of Measure 14 and further testing for gold, he can see great potential in Oregon's gold mining future. For Pacifica Network News, I'm Alexi Rubenstein in Portland.
A bright light on the left went out this morning. Editor Irwin Knoll died in his sleep at the age of 63. Cindy Simmons of member station WORT has more.
Irwin Knoll's unexpected passing shocked his friends and co-workers. Irwin Knoll was probably best known as the editor of the monthly magazine, The Progressive. He also defied the government in 1979 by publishing directions on how to make a nuclear bomb. Irwin Knoll served as Second Opinion's host. That's a weekly interview show carried by public radio stations. He appeared regularly as a commentator representing the left on National Public Radio, the McNeil Lara News Hour, and Pacifica Radio. Peace activist Sam Day, who used to work with Irwin Knoll at The Progressive, remembered his friend as one of the left's most articulate spokespersons.
I think the country has lost the most eloquent voice of progressivism and one of the finest minds on the left. It's lost a person who was able to articulate the ideals and principles of the left in language which the mainstream understood.
Sam Day says Erwin Noll was an absolutist on free speech, taking an unpopular stance when Nazis wanted to march in Skokie, Illinois.
I met Erwin at a cocktail party in Chicago during the time of the Skokie case, when the Nazis were trying to march in Skokie, and just about everybody in Skokie and in the United States was against the idea of their being given a permit. And Erwin was one of the few editors who supported the right to march in Skokie, even though as a Jew himself, he could identify more than most people with the horrors of Nazism. And he came up to the me at the party and said, you know, I get a lot of letters accusing me of being anti-Semitic, and here I am a Jew. So he got some wry humor out of being characterized as being anti-Jewish.
That was peace activist and journalist Sam Day talking about Erwin Noll. Erwin Noll died in his sleep this morning. For Pacifica Network News, I'm Cindy Simmons.
A Florida jury has convicted anti-abortion activist Paul Hill of first-degree murder. It took them only 20 minutes to reach the verdict. Hill shot and killed an abortion doctor and his escort outside a clinic in Pensacola, Florida, in July. Hill was his own attorney and questioned no witnesses throughout the trial. The 40-year-old also offered no closing arguments today. Hill had wanted to argue that killing the abortion doctor was justifiable homicide, but the judge refused to allow that argument. Now that the jury has convicted Hill of first-degree murder, they must recommend whether he will be sentenced to death.
And you are listening to the WBAI Evening News. I'm Jose Santiago in New York. A Catholic priest and human rights activist, Father Roy Bourgeois, says that he's committed to lifting the veil of secrecy from the U.S. Army's School of the Americas. According to Bourgeois, graduates of the military training school are Latin American soldiers responsible for assassinations, coups, and massacres in nations as diverse as Haiti, El Salvador, Guatemala, Peru, and Bolivia. Earlier this year, Massachusetts Representative Joseph Kennedy introduced a bill to close the School of the Americas. The bill failed in a close vote, and Kennedy plans to try again during the next session of Congress. Meanwhile, Father Roy Bourgeois continues his four-year vigil at the school at Fort Benning, Georgia, a vigil that began a year after School of the Americas graduates were implicated in the murder of six Jesuit priests and their housekeepers in El Salvador. Father Bourgeois spoke with WBAI's Paul DiRienzo, and he chronicles the history of the institution he calls the School of Assassins.
It began in Panama way back in 1946. That's trained over the years some 57,000 officers and enlisted men from Latin America. Became known in the 60s as the School of Coups because so many of the graduates became their country's dictators. Some of those graduates, Manuel Noriega from Panama, doing 40 years in the U.S. federal prison for drug running. Roberto Dubuisson, another graduate, the well-known death squad leader from El Salvador. General Hugo Banzer, that I lived under in Bolivia for 5 years during the 70s. This is a brutal dictator. Not only a graduate, but in 1988 he was inducted into the school's Hall of Fame, where today his photograph hangs on the wall in the Hall of Fame with some 18 other generals from Latin America. But let me see, the school was kicked out of Panama in 1984 and very quietly settled at Fort Benning, Georgia. When that school left Panama, La Prensa, a principal newspaper there, dubbed it the School of Assassins, where soldiers from Latin America are taught to kill their people. And this is how we see this school, as a School of Assassins. This year, there will be about 2,000 soldiers from 18 countries in Latin America and the Caribbean will be trained at this school. It's some of the courses, commando operations, there's a sniper course, interrogation techniques, psychological operations. Most of the courses come under what they call counterinsurgency techniques. Who are the insurgents? They are the poor. They are the people in Latin America and the Caribbean who call for reform.
Who are some of the graduates of the United States Army's School of the Americas in Haiti and other countries with horrendous human rights records?
Not long ago, before actually he went into exile, Lieutenant General Raul Cedras had an interview on CNN where he actually thanked the United States for training 75% of the Haitian military. Many of them went through the School of the Americas. I want to say also many of those officers were trained at the School of the Americas after the coup, after the military forced President Aristide out of Haiti. Brigadier General Felipe Biambi and Lieutenant Colonel Joseph Michel Francois trained at Fort Benning's Infantry School. I want to say that the military defends this school by saying that they want to professionalize the militaries of Latin America. Well, that's the problem. They are too professional today. Unless they turn over their power and their control to civilians, there will be no hope for the poor in Latin America or in the Caribbean.
Father Bourgeois, how did you learn of the School of the Americas?
When the United Nations Truth Commission report was made public and cited those massacres in El Salvador, and we learned from Army documents that 72% of those cited in that UN Truth Commission report were trained at the School of the Americas. The massacre of the six Jesuits and two women, 27 officers responsible for that massacre, 19 of them trained at the School of the Americas. The assassination of Bishop O'Merrill, the rape and murder of four church women, the El Masote massacre, where over 900 unarmed men, women, and 131 children under the age of 12 were killed. The majority of the officers responsible for those massacres received their training at the U.S. Army School of the Americas. But I want to say we're not only talking about El Salvador. We're talking about Haiti. We're talking about Colombia, Peru, Honduras. At the school today, for example, there are instructors from Guatemala.